According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, almost 1.5 million children have a mother or father in prison. A majority of children with imprisoned parents have children under the age of 10. My name's Melissa Goodman, and this is Reentry Reframed, a Mirror, Inc. sponsored podcast. I have with me today a guest who we're trying to capture through a child's eyes your perspective, what it was like growing up with an incarcerated parent. I have Casey Kern. I always want to add an S and make you plural. Casey
just
Kern.
One of me. Just one.
Just one. Thank you so much for traveling here today and being a part of this. I really appreciate you making the drive because your story is incredible.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Let's jump right in. So tell the audience, like 1,000 people, tell our listeners a little bit about you.
Well, my name is Casey Kern. I am with Valley Hope Addiction Treatment and Recovery. It was a lifelong goal to be employed here and make a difference and try to be an influential change in the substance abuse world. I'm from a small town in southern Illinois, DuQuoin, Illinois. Both my mom and my dad's side for several generations was in that small town, which is where my mom and dad met.
Your parents were very young when they had you. How old were they?
My parents were 15. My mom was 15 and my dad was 17. And they were very young, both struggling and navigating family dynamics and mental health issues and dealing with addiction themselves, even at that age, starting with alcohol.
So if we can kind of start back to, we'll just go kind of thinking past, present, future and walk everyone through your life, I guess, in a way. So as a child, what was life like for you? What did life look like for you?
Exciting yet dangerous. Well, I just remember my dad had full custody of me and is a blessing in disguise, you know. He definitely saved my life. But as a child, dealing with, you know, having a mother who was an addict, who was an alcoholic, and who struggled navigating mental health issues herself, I didn't understand. So life was rather confusing. And there was this burning desire that just craving, like that love for my mom and my dad. You know, he worked a lot. He provided for three stepchildren that he took in as his own. So it was confusing. I remember little coping mechanisms that I had to do growing up. Like one time when my mom was gone and, you know, rehab and halfway houses, I didn't understand that. It wasn't explained to me. It was just mom's gone.
She was gone.
Yeah. And so I remember writing her a letter and putting it in one of the free envelopes that comes with your bill. And I cut out the stamp from a different piece of mail and tried to tape it on this envelope to mail my mom a letter telling her how much I loved her and I missed her and to come home. And I think I just put "to mom" on the front and handed it to the mailman. And he looked at it and he was like, "Sweetie, I can't accept this." And that was heartbreaking. But it was, you know, those times where it was difficult and tough to understand and navigate.
How old were you at the time?
Probably 7.
Did your father always have custody of you?
Yes.
Were your parents together for a period of time or were they always apart?
Yeah, my dad likes to say, you know, he wanted to do the right thing. So he married my mom. He's what you do. In a small town, you get married to the girl. And he's like, I bought her a house. I bought her new carpets. I bought her new counters and I bought her a car. When she bought the car, she left. And that's kind of what happened. Yeah, they tried to work in it for about a year and a half and they're just young. You know, I asked my dad, I said, "Did you ever love my mom?" And he said, "You know, Case, I loved your mom as much as I knew how to love your mom at 17. And I loved Beth as much as I knew how to at, you know, 25 and 35, you know, and that just always resonated with me because so often craving, you know, your parents' love is like, oh, you're left with this desire to be loved and accepted and understand. And that provided an understanding for me that even if my little boyfriends didn't work out, it's not that I wasn't good enough. It's just that we just loved each other as much as we knew how to at that point. So that was, you know, a little parental advice that dad gave me that I don't think he realized was so impactful for me.
When you were around your mother and when you did spend time together, what were those situations like and those experiences? I'm sure you held on to them dearly.
Oh, yes. My mom could make anything a home. It wouldn't matter if it's a house, a trailer, a tent. That woman, she had an eye for everything being home. And outside of the chaos and the extremes, the highs and the lows, my favorite memories is pulling up to my mom's house on the driveway on the side and being able to skip on the stepping stones that led to the back door, seeing her rock garden and, you know, her beautiful flowers and shrubs. She took great pride in that. Lawn mowing and Captain and Diet was her thing. And so those smells are still sweet to me. My mom, she was a life of the party. She's very charismatic and giving and outgoing. And she had this big green eyes, blonde hair, olive skin. And when she walked in, everybody just looked at her like, what is she going to say? What is she going to do? And she always had homemade desserts and homemade dinner and candles burning, little tea lights everywhere. The house had all the five senses, you know. Mm-hmm. The smells, the sights, sees 30 throw blankets. And so she made home as much as she could until she started drinking. And then, like, when her voice would change, that's when it was like, we better stay away. We better stay away.
Was it a daily thing using some sort of substance?
Yes. I remember, like, I mean, my uncle's 2 years older than me, and he is by far one of the most important men in my life, my biggest idol, my biggest inspiration. I love that man. But he's 2 years older than me, and my mom raised us both as, like, her own children. And I remember we were sitting at the kitchen table playing Monopoly, mm-hmm. and she was losing. She didn't get the railroad, and she was throwing a fit. I was like, Mom, just chill. Take a Vicodin. And although it was a comical moment for her at that time, but that aha, that woo, my child realizes all I have to do is take this pill and my behavior will be changed. I'll be fine. I know that that is a comic relief. However, it is a very touchy subject for my mom.
So how old do you think you were whenever you realized, wow, something's going on?
Oh, as early as 5 or 6.
What about it felt abnormal to you from maybe going to friends' houses or things like that? What led you to believe things were not right?
I mean, I have always known from a very early age that I was different, even different from my step siblings. They didn't have the same struggle as I did. Their mom was clean and, you know, she had my home my dad was providing. But yeah, it was different. It's not normal to be driving around, you know, riding with your mom, butterfly knifing tires over a tennis bracelet, you know, or driving around with my dad in the Jeep looking for his ex-wife in local bars, you know. I mean, they made it fun, so it was always an experience, but I knew it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. Even still to this day, like one of Slim Shady's 8 Mile albums, mm-hmm. that takes me back to riding around in the Jeep looking for my stepmom at the bars, you know. And there was domestic violence in the home as well. And my dad's anger and need for an outlet wasn't always done in the appropriate way. And so as he had been aggressive with, you know, us kids, but me specifically, you know, going to my mom's house and taking a bath, my mom would be like, oh my gosh. And then she would take the pictures and then they'd have their back and forth. And, you know, and it seemed that if my stepmom had, the only way she could get to my dad was to get through me. And so I noticed that leverage early on, that was the only thing that could get a reaction out of my dad was she was putting her hands on me. And when she put her hands on me, my dad put her hands on her. And then when my mom came to pick up, she got round two for my mom. And it was just like this constant cycle, being caught as a child in this alcohol, insecure, young. I mean, I forget that they're 21 years old, you know, 22 years old doing this, behaving this way. Being in my 30s now, I think, oh, golly, I couldn't imagine.
I just picture you and I picture a little girl in the middle of a storm. Mm. Like when you're talking, that's how I picture it.
Yeah, and, you know, my stepmom, although she wasn't a very kind lady to me, I admired her in many ways. I thought she was beautiful. You know, she definitely inspired my girliness because my mom's a tomboy. Mm-hmm. But Beth, she's very popular. Everybody in the community loved her. She volunteered a lot. She's big in the church. And I think that was the foundation of my faith, is seeing her and being active in the church, even though I didn't agree with the church, even at that age. It's just kind of funny to think as an adult. But that foundation of my faith is definitely comes from my stepmom. My girliness, my attention to hygiene and stuff, that all comes from my stepmom.
One of the things I picked up on you throughout numerous conversations is your ability to see the bright side and positive yes. side of things. It's pretty admirable. So
thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate that about you.
Yeah, I don't have a victimized mentality. Actually, I'm rather brutally impatient with those victimized mentalities. I have a comic relief, which is not for everybody, but it doesn't mean that my situation's not serious. Mm-hmm. I'm just so used to it. And that comic relief is just how my parents cope. And that's how I cope. And it's how we cope together. You know, it's just kind of, it is what it is. So let's take it for what it is.
You and your mother connected while she was away, either incarcerated or in treatment. What was one of the ways you guys connected?
Oh, yes. So this is one of my biggest heart clutches. My ma and I had wrote poetry back and forth as early as I can remember, you know, and I kept every letter, every poem in a binder. And our goal was to publish this binder full of these letters and correspondence and poetry. But yeah, writing letters back and forth and poetry was a big thing that helped. I didn't realize how therapeutic that is, even until like recently when I start journaling again. And it is extremely therapeutic to hear your thoughts and be able to identify those words and compose sentence fragments to something beautiful, like a song that expresses your feelings. It's meaningful. So we wrote poems and letters back and forth. Every year I would, for Mother's Day, I would color on a blank computer sheet of paper. I would color 3/4 of the paper green crayon, and about the other 1/4 of the paper, different colors, pink, red, purple. And I would fold it up and trifold it and mail it to her. And wherever she was, she knew what that meant. And when she opened that colored sheet of just 2 colors, she would roll it up vertically, and you'd twist the green part and it would look like little paper roses. Mm. And I mean, early on, as early as 7, 8 years old, I remember making her a bouquet of those flowers, and she put them in a vase that stuck or that sat on top, the top shelf in the kitchen. And come to find out, that vase was a bong and not a vase at all. So yeah, that's one way another way we kept in touch, writing and those little flower things. She'd send me recipes. My mom is an outstanding chef. She's a little bit of everything, carpenter, electrician, mm-hmm. you know, like a little bit of everything, but she is a chef and she is a phenomenal cook. She would win all kinds of contests, hands down the best. So she sends me recipes as well. I never try them, but I like them. I like getting them.
Well, and it shows she's thinking about you, mm-hmm. and it's her way of making mm-hmm. you feel special.
It is, very much. It is. And that was one way that we were connected, is obviously through food, but mm-hmm. we know how to season.
Good.
And we cook more Southern. Grandpa and stuff's from Tennessee, so we like them Southern flavors.
Yes, I'm all about seasoning. Mm-hmm. One of the poems you brought, the poem you have in front of you, if you'd read it, I mean, it looks mm-hmm. like it's been opened 100,000 times.
Yes, to say the least. So this poem is a poem my mom wrote me December 31st of 2004. And this poem was written about me, but, you know, through my mom's eyes. So this is very sweet and sentimental to me. So
how old were you at this time?
I was 14 years old.
Okay.
I just turned 14. So she said, "There's this girl as beautiful as a flower, her being filled with sorrow every day, every hour. A girl so sweet and awesomely neat, a girl so torn, so emotionally worn. The one thing she wanted was ultimately stunned, in need of her mom, her heartfelt loss. Mom's loss to selfish addictions, a coin toss. Mom was so close yet so far, usually found in a local bar, needing to talk, to be understood. Where is her mother now? Not where she should. A life of separation, a daughter's desperation. Only having her dad, that would always end up mad. We're turning the tables, making her bad. An attempt to take control, and result, her childhood stole. Who is she? What is she? Will she ever fit in? I pray too she doesn't turn to a life of sin. Feeling so empty, nowhere to turn. There must be some lesson to learn. Hold your head high, time to move on. Don't worry, little girl, moms are never gone. She wants to be mad, even call it quits. That thought leaves her crying in fits. Be strong, yet tender. It's hard to do. Believe it or not, moms do pull through. You ask, how does she know her so well? She wasn't always around to know her hell. You must move on for now, without guilt or fear. Don't worry, honey, my return to new is near. I was once her, too. I regret I blindingly did it to you. My little girl nearly grown, with no help of my own. Forgive me, Mom." And that's one thing that is consistent through all of her letters, all of her cards, anything that my mom has written me. She always signs off, "Forgive me. Forgive me, Mom." And 1/4, that's for "I love you" is our other thing. My dad started that, and I'm sure he's not the first person on the planet. But my family and my world, it came from my dad.
What is the 1/4?
It means "I love you." And so with my dad working so much and my mom being absent, my dad worked 11 to 11, or he would get up sometimes in the morning just to see us off to the bus stop, and he would stand on the porch and finger like 1, 4, 3. Oh. Or if I was cheering at a game, I'd look up and my dad was always 1, 4, 3 in me. Graduation, any of my work banquets. Charity stuff.
That's incredibly sweet.
It's real sweet. It's special. It's something that we've passed on to my sister and my child, and it's something special. Yes, it's amazing because my mom is she's so bright. It's unfortunate that her life has been consumed with anger and guilt and resentment, all of these lingering feelings from her childhood trauma, that it's amazing just how her life is just deteriorated by these emotions.
She makes a comment in her poem and she says, "I was you." What does she mean by that, if you can share?
Yeah, so my mom has, the only thing she's known is betrayal, abandonment, neglect, these negative, traumatic, just emotions. And by blindingly doing it to us, it fills her with that guilt and that resentment of herself and that ashamed feeling of herself. But my mom was born into an addict, an alcoholic family as well. What you do in the small town. And her dad had overdosed on heroin. And my grandma, she's totally different now. Okay. My grandma was an alcoholic. And so my great-grandma raised my mother. And it wasn't that my mother was necessarily a troubled child at that time. But when they don't have the funds or the resources to help raise on a whole other child, they passed around the family. And so that created that sense of neglect and abandonment and that sense of being unwanted. And so she tried hard to fit in, and she was really great at basketball. And again, my mom's stunning. she met my dad, who's a rebel with long hair and slicked back and a little Trans Am, and he was cool with a little leather jacket and that Metallica, and it was just a rebel side. And I'm not saying that my mom wasn't already into that, because you can't just turn somebody into that. She's already been exposed to a lot of that. But it was exciting. It was thrilling. It was a sense of her new beginning and being codependent and insecure and having those residual negative emotions from her childhood carried over into this young teenage love, and to get pregnant on Valentine's Day and have me November 14th at 15 years old. And she turned 16 in August and had me in November, but essentially 15 pregnant.
Learning more about your mother too, I'm sure her very best intention was being the mother to you, that she had never seen. I'm sure her intention was to be present and all of that stuff. It sounds like she had so much trauma without treatment.
In the 90s, we think of mental health like that's taboo. They moved on, and she got remarried to my brother's dad, and he is just a king. Like, he was a coal miner, a good old country boy. He gave her absolutely everything she wanted. And I think that unhealed childhood trauma had this sense of chaos inside. And even though outside she had the white house and two kids, the cars, the boat, the fishing, the husband, she had it all, everything that she wanted. But this chaos inside of her, I think, was just fueled with unhealed trauma and rage that she acted out. She was essentially, I think she was bored. And I don't think she wanted to be bored. But again, mental health, no way. It's just so stigmatized, especially in the 90s, where it's like, oh, she's an alcoholic, or she's an addict, or, oh, she wants attention. Oh, that's just Mandy. Well, yeah, it might be Mandy, but to her core, what do you think's wrong? Let's look at that. Let's stop judging her bad decisions, and let's treat the underlying disease. Let's treat what's going on in her head. Yeah.
I mean, we've had numerous conversations, and it sounds just like a lot of open wounds that never healed. Mm-hmm. So once she lived with your stepfather and your little brother, what did life look like for you both?
I still think it was filled with those extreme highs and lows. I mean, we had my mom, she really tried hard to be a mom, and this might be too TMI, but I have to share this. Especially shame. So, Tommy Hilfiger is making its way back into style. When I had started my menstrual, I went to my mom's house and I laid down and, had to be in bed, and I didn't understand what was going on because I felt fine, but whatever. And I woke up to, guests and company and hearing them, the chatter in the dining room. And I came out there, and of course she had chicken dumplings made, which is our special thing. And German chocolate cake.
Mm.
And then there was all these presents on the table. And I was like, what in the hell? And they're like, my mom, she's drunk. And her friends were all drunk. And she was like, my little girl's a woman now. And they all gave me like a gift into womanhood. But it was like a Tommy Hilfiger dress. I'll never forget it. Yellow polo, just a dress one. But I was so humiliated and so embarrassed because I'm like, Mom, why are you telling my business? And it's funny because my daughter does the same thing to me. And I'm like, it's not that big of a deal, girl, but it is, you know. And to me, that was, at the time, it was humiliating. But looking back, anytime I see Tommy Hilfiger, yes, I think my mama didn't know how to navigate this next step. And so, like a typical party girl, let's throw a party but bring presents, so it's okay.
Yeah, right. I'm like, I didn't get anything.
I know, yeah. But I mean, with my brother, I mean, I remember us going to the beach, and you know, my brother was sitting on my lap, and he was I was probably 9, and you know, he's 2 or so, and this he was sitting on my lap, and our car is just packed, like full kids, the adults up front drinking, you know. And my brother went to spit out the front, like out one of the windows, but the windows were down. It came back and it smacked me in the face. But it was one of those moments that my mom was looking back from the passenger side and just admiring us kids. And she's seen my brother lean up and hawk and try to spit the loogie out the window, but it hit me in the face. And she's seen it like from front to back. And I just remember like catching her staring at us. And then I got hit in the face with it. And I was like, Mom. But she couldn't stop laughing because she's seen the whole thing. And I know that that's one of those memories, because there's very few and far between memories with my brother and I and her.
That makes you sad talking about your brother.
It does. I don't have really many regrets in my life, but my little brother, he's 8 years younger than I, and Caden is one of my biggest regrets. Whenever I moved to Kansas City, I was maybe 11 years old. My brother's 8 years younger than that. You know, he lived with his father. Our mom was all over the town, in and out of the newspapers. But my dad saved my life moving to Kansas City. And so, of course, that 11 to 13, my mom and I kept writing letters and poetry. And I wouldn't know when I would get to see her. And 13 to 15, I ran back every chance I could. Every weekend, it's snow day, let's run back. Like, who does that? And every time I would go back, my brother lived with his father in a different town. I didn't have a driver's license. I was excited to go hang out with Uncle Jeremy, 2 years older than me. You know, again, I'm at 13.
You're a teenager.
And 15 years old. I wasn't really thinking like, oh, let me go scoop my little 4-year-old brother.
Yeah.
I was excited to hang out with my 2-year older uncle. And then whenever I did get my license, and I would run back home every chance I could, my mom was drunk, and she said some real ugly stuff that she shared that my brother had said to her. And it didn't make me feel good. And I, at that age, you know, 16 years old, I didn't reach out to my little brother, 8, and be like, Caden, did you say this? You know? And I held on to that. There's certain things that is hard for me to come back from. Maybe that's the Scorpio in me, but my mom's comment was that my brother had said something racist, and that really bothered me. And I just ignored it. You know, I ignored him. I abandoned him. Essentially, and that's how he felt. It was like, you came home and you would always hang out with Uncle Jeremy, or even in my young adult life, I was dating a man from there who actually moved to Kansas City. And anytime I'd go back home to his house, Caden's like, you never hit me up, you never. And I was like, dang, I didn't realize that, you know. One, all this time has passed, but two, I didn't even know he cared or he noticed me. And that's not an excuse, because at the end of the day, the little boy felt abandoned. He felt neglected. He felt those same feelings that my mom felt. And I blindingly did it to him, just as our mother blindingly did it to us.
Why do you think your mom told you that about your brother?
My mom, especially under the influence, my mom creates chaos. And we've all known this. Anywhere Mandy goes, there's chaos. Mm-hmm. And because it's raging inside of her. And when she's abandoned both of us kids and been abandoned herself, and then she sees us sticking together, or sees us together, I don't know. I don't know if she wants to lose her power or lose her position in our life or be the glue that held us together, but wasn't strong enough to hold us together, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think she said that because she was under the influence, and maybe she didn't want us to be as close because, you know, Caden got it worse than I did. He got a worse mom than I did. And he was there in Southern Illinois. He's a football star, you know, at the time. And he had to deal with the humiliation of mom's name being in the paper, mom being arrested, mom being drug out of a bar or picked up randomly, or, you know, Caden had to live that. His peers, parents seen that. Whereas I'm in Kansas City, you know, it was almost like, and I'm high energy, low access. I've always been that way and didn't really care what parents of Smithville thought of me. Mm-hmm. I thought it was ugly. It didn't feel good. It hurt my feelings. I still feel to this day like shame on you. Mm-hmm. Because again, I'm a child, you know, and you don't even know what's going on. I think, you know, with Caden was my mom's first true and only love. And the fact that she had all of the tools to be a successful mother and she still decided to selfishly put, and these are her words, not mine. She says she selfishly put her addiction first. And that's all you know. And even in the time in between that she had experienced some love with her mom, it was just toxic because they're both unhealed. And even though they can say, oh, I'm sorry, I love you, it just is more of a notion than a belief. But where things really had pivoted in my life from Southern Illinois to Kansas City, about 11, 12 years old, before we moved to Kansas City, my dad and I moved here. My great-grandmother, who was my mother's figure, she had passed away in her early 50s. She had lung transplant or something. And got out of surgery, was fine, and then she just passed away suddenly. And that chopped my mom's beautiful blonde hair off. She got tattoos. I mean, she came home with Caden on her neck, and I was like, Mom, did you get a tattoo? She's like, did I spell it right? I'm like, oh, no, Mom. But she was lost. Mm-hmm. And then that happened in May, and the following year, my dad moved me to Kansas City without blessing. He's like, is a new chapter for him. And it did save my life. And he knew that. But Mom and I didn't understand that. And I will never forget meeting her at the Ducoin storage unit, picking up my day bed and a little touch lamp and Moons and Stars comforter. And it got loaded in the back of the Jeep. And I remember seeing my mom in the side view mirror, just hysterical. And I didn't understand why. I was just thought she would be used to those extended absences. But I remember feeling like every other time that we've departed one another was, when is the next time I'll get to see her? And as her addiction progressed, even to this day in my adult life, as that addiction progressed, it went from when am I going to see her next to I hope she's still alive. Where, you know, she got a lot of DUIs, or driving on suspendeds. And in Southern Illinois, ATVs are considered a motor vehicle. So a country girl, of course, riding a four-wheeler, she got a couple more DUIs and she ended up going to prison. And when she got out of prison, she got into meth. And my mom, growing up, she was always open and honest with me about drugs. She didn't hide it. She was safe, but not sheltered. And I mean, remember going to Panama City Beach and being like, Mom, I didn't do drugs. I'm working and trying to get through school. But when we were in Panama City Beach, I was like, Mom, they got Molly, mushrooms, and marijuana. It was like, what color is the Molly? Leave the mushrooms alone. If you want to try anything, smoke so you go to sleep, you know? And, you know, going from such an open and honest relationship dynamic like that, I mean, she educated me on the game without necessarily including me in there.
Or encouraging you.
Encouraging, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, she's like, don't mess with the mushrooms. You're too much in your head anyway. Woo-woo. You know? So when she started lying to me, though, post-prison a few years ago, that's like everybody in the family and her friends are like, Mandy, same thing, different day. Blah, blah, blah. But for me, I always had like a little soft spot for her outside of being my mom. Like, one, she's really cool. But two, like, I got to learn so much. And when she started lying to me, though, and deceiving me and, you know, stealing my identity, and I can't mess with that. I have a real problem with deception. I have a real problem with dishonesty. And it's okay if I'm willing to make myself look foolish on your behalf. Yeah. But you don't get to make me look foolish on your behalf without me knowing. And
it sounds like you're very protective of her. And it sounds like you felt betrayed.
I did feel betrayed, very much. I've learned as I've navigated my mental health and, you know, growing up in healthcare, essentially, and that abandonment and betrayal are big triggers for me as well, and that deception, and that it comes from both my child, like my childhood of both my parents and being raised in that. And yeah, I'm a little protective of my mom. And, you know, one thing that I admire about my father is it does not matter what shenanigans my mom had put me through, drug me through, you know, whatever. My dad has never spoke ill of my mom. And it wasn't until I had my child where I'm like, how do you not say anything? And he just did it. One time when I was 15, I got down to Southern Illinois in this Tamaro Tea Trailer Park.
Okay.
And it was a trap trailer, essentially. It was home, but it was like a trap trailer that weekend. And there was drugs everywhere. It was a mess. But my dad had to come back down to Kansas City. Like, as soon as he got home, he had to turn around and come back down to Southern Illinois to pick me up. It was a mess. You know, ambulances coming, people was foaming out the mouth and comatose shocking. And it was a mess. And then whenever it's just my uncle, 2 years older than I, me and one of his buddies, and we're waiting on my dad to come, and the ambulance are there, lights are on, people are like scurrying, like trying to get their drugs, but not, you know, it was just a mess. It was a mess. And it wasn't until a little later when my dad had made the joke about, oh, I don't remember how the setup went, but my dad made the joke about, oh, how the trailer park girls really around the outside, around the outside. And
two trailer park girls go around the outside, around the outside.
It was just a little comic relief, but it was just enough to take the pain away, the edge off, you know, feeling supported, but also humanizing the situation.
and acknowledging that this was something, you know.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I think it was just epic. I mean, I think I got in the car. He's like, well, at least we know the trailer park girl's really around the outside or something. It's like one of those like head and palm moments, but
it's like a dad joke, but in a really serious situation.
Very much so. Very much so.
Before we talk about some of your adulthood, if it's okay, I want to jump back over to ask a question about Caden. Your mom had a way of connecting with you through writing and poetry and all of these really beautiful ways. Did she have a way of staying connected with him while she was away?
I think for the longest part, I mean, no, Caden, not like me, you know. I think Caden, he got a worse mom than I did. Caden was left in the apartment with the door open while she was at the bar a block over. Caden got it worse than I did. And I don't know if it's just because she just gave up, accepted defeat or not, but the older he got, the more humiliating it got and the more he distanced himself. But it always seemed, up until she went to prison and got out about 2017, it just seemed mom could call or text and they would just be united all over again like nothing ever happened. But mom's meth charge really, really broke Caden's heart. And Caden's just like, I'm done with this.
Has he been?
Yeah. He's like, I'm done with you both. I haven't needed you both in my entire life. Like, why do you think I need you now? And I'm like, I don't think you need me now. I just miss you. And having the last 15 years wishing and hoping and praying to have a connection with my brother. I mean, I can say happy birthday or reach out to him, but my mom went to prison that last time. He blocked my number, so I have limited access to him. And I asked, like, I wish we had a relationship. Like, can I come see you? And he's just like, what's the point now? What is the point? And I understand, like, I don't expect to come in on a white horse and, I don't know, you beat up my boyfriends or something. Like, but I would like to have a relationship with you. I'd like to know who you are. I'd like to know that you're not alone in this situation. And I would like to be able to educate on the mental health aspect because he is a country boy and he has a lifetime of abandonment from my mom and neglect and humiliation and betrayal. And I wish I could know him and love him. He said, I don't even remember the last time I've seen you. And I'm like, I do. We were at Arthur's house with my Uncle Jeremy, and I had that same feeling that I had with mom at the storage unit. Like, when am I going to see you again? And there's been times I've gone back and I've tried, you know, seeing him, but he's like, oh, I'm stuck at work, or, you know, it just wasn't convenient, or maybe he got cold feet, or maybe he just don't want to deal with me either. And that's okay, even though it doesn't feel okay, but he's entitled to his feelings. And 20 years of feeling that way by the two women in his life, his mom and his sister, like, oh, I would have some anger too. I would have some resentment too. But it is my goal to reconnect with him. It is my goal to have him accept mom and understand. that it is beyond just addiction, that addiction is truly a disease. And just because she's gone to prison doesn't mean that she's a bad person. It doesn't mean that her disease defines her. She's a person suffering with a disease. She is inside of a glass house screaming for help, and everybody's sitting outside with their popcorn and headphones on, just watching and observing and judging and laughing. All she's known, you know. And then when she does feel love, she says she messes it up herself just to see if it's real, until it's pushed away, and then she doesn't realize it's real until it's already gone.
And self-destruction.
Very much. But from 2004, those letters, I remember in June of 2004, I distinctively wrote my letter to her drugs when she was in rehab, marking my words that I'm coming for you, drugs. And although the letter was youthful, it was rather profound for that age. And I had just always known that I wanted to grow up and make a difference in desensitizing the stigma of mental health and substance abuse. I knew that I was different from a very young age, like different. And I had people tell me that. And I believe I'm a walking testimony. I know that I'm destined for greatness. I know that these trials and tribulations have a purpose, and it's grander than my vision. And I'm very passionate about the prison system, the reentry program. I'm very passionate about substance abuse.
You mentioned at one point, your past trauma prepares you for your future trauma. Can you lead into what you meant by that?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's very, very true. So my past trauma, abandonment and neglect and the betrayal and the deception and domestic violence, that was my normal life. That was normal home life, you know, even though it was a twisted, but domestic violence wasn't a thing. Where when I had my child with her father, I wasn't opposed to doing a mouth pop or a spanking. And that's something that he was rather adamant about. And he said, you know, we don't need to put our hands on her. And I'm like, that aha moment. We want her to respect us and not fear us. And I don't have to spank my child to this day. You know, she obeys. And we use those words, obey, opposed to listening. Even until the last, you know, 3 or 4 years of parenting, co-parenting, and I have the greatest father for my child. Like, if I made a list of the qualities of the best father of my child before I had a kid, he would definitely exceed those qualities. He's a great dad. But the last 3-4 years he's been with his lady, I felt that my perception that she had grounded him, and that wasn't actually accurate. I realized that she's grounded me more, and through their love together, is it like radiates, you know, and it's grounded me, and it's like, oh, I don't have to spank my child, which I haven't, but sure. It was just like one of those like moments. And I don't spank my child, everybody.
I know what you're saying. I think people understand that.
They just feel and cherish. His relationship has taught me healthy boundaries and a healthy love, a pure love that I've not seen this close in my family aside. You know, my Aunt Erin and Uncle Ben, they are the idol couple, and they have a huge influence on me as well. Some things that just aren't normal from childhood trauma, where I grow up and I didn't realize, like, oh, I'm prying or I'm poking or I'm festering this or I'm egging this on. I didn't realize that because I thought I was standing up for myself. I thought that I was communicating. And how are you supposed to know how I feel? I don't have to say everything. Okay? I am hyper attentive to detail and I don't have to call everything out. I felt this urge to do so, which is a really toxic trait. It is really unhealthy. Like, the power is really in your silence. The power is to be able to check something in your head, but keep your mouth closed, you know? And I've just learned that a lot of my childhood trauma has really affected my adult relationships and my thinking and my clarity. And although I've never really allowed anything to hinder my trajectory on my successful path, I have definitely could have had a path of least resistance simply based on my own attitude. Even though I am resilient and persistent, ambitious, I'm hungry for that knowledge, but I get in my own way sometimes. And I don't realize that until I'm like, holy crap. I'm triggered. Yeah. This is trauma. And to identify those red flags and those behaviors, I've realized, okay, that's what this is. You know, that's gaslighting or that's manipulating or this is passive aggressive. I can't stand that. Say what you feel, mean what you say, you know, but at the same time, you have to be strategic and selective.
Sure.
And just because I've been there, I've done that, doesn't mean that I need to talk about it, you know, all the time or call it out. And I feel like I'm still being finessed into the best version of myself. I'm still growing and elevating. I'm still navigating this uncharted territory, even though it's very familiar. It's beautiful to have a co-parent that can help keep my parenting in line so I'm not passing that trauma on to our child. I do educate my child just as my mom did me. And I did receive some backlash on that initially, but I say, my kid's going to be safe, not sheltered. Deal with your kid. And she understands now, like telling her about grandma in prison and educating her on grandma's drug addiction. This is new to us. I mean, my mom was bougie with her drugs and that meth was a no-no growing up. And when she got into it, it really deteriorated her mental health. It really deteriorated of what I knew of my mom. Everything that she embodied was no longer of matter. It was no longer of care. She just gave up. She says she feels like that, like on The Little Mermaid, where Ursula turns them into those little things. That's how she felt on meth. She was like, I was my own person, then I'm just like. And so one way I had freestyled educating my child on grandma's addiction. And she said, Rylan said, Mama, I don't like hearing grandma's voice. I don't even know why she calls. She doesn't even talk to us. She didn't have a conversation. She never asks about me. And it's because mom spun out and she's everywhere but there, but she knows she's supposed to be on the phone with us, right? And we got the phone and I was like, well, honey, grandma's head hurts and her heart hurts. And because her heart hurts, makes her head a little wonky, right? And it was about a year and a half, 2 years before she realized it's something a little bit more. And she got inquisitive about jail before my mom had returned. And so we looked it up and she asks about different reasons why people go to jail and all that. And it was always very imperative for her father and I to let her know that good people are in jail too. Just because they're in jail doesn't mean they're a bad person. They made a bad decision. And we're all half a second away from making that same bad decision that could get us life in prison, all of us. Yeah. And it's important to have control of our mental health and our emotions to help prevent from enabling those behaviors before we go too. And Rylan's very accepting of people in jail and people who use bad candy. She just wants to make a difference as well.
So I know you are a cancer survivor. Mm-hmm. Are you okay talking about your cancer journey as
I am.
Well?
I am. Yes. So I was diagnosed with cancer during my pregnancy. We went to go get the gender revealed for the baby and there was another mass tumor. And of course, her dad and I are like looking at the sonogram. Does it have a heartbeat? Because, you know, that comic relief again. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that that mass was, you know, cancerous. And I was, well, long story short, we just went to, we were able to go full term, had a healthy, successful pregnancy, right? Beautiful, healthy child. They had sewed me up and I went back nine months later, September of 2015. And I had like a big old ball tumor, my lower abdomen. I was like, what is this? I've never had a beer belly, but this hurts, mm-hmm. You know, marketing in and out with my DONs. You should get that checked out. And it was cancerous. And so I had to have a total hysterectomy at 24 years old. Wow. And that summer I struggled with egg preservation. You know, my physician was like, honey, the way you feel at 24, you won't feel at 34 and just do it. And I drug my feet on it for a little bit and I prayed on it a lot. And I just thought, you know, God, if you want me to have a child, you will have a way for that. If you want me to have another child, you'll give me a way for that. And they thought that the worst case scenario would be chopping off like a fallopian tube and an ovary. But when they got in, they realized that it was embedded in my uterus and they had to do a total hysterectomy at that time when I didn't have egg preservation. So they took out the baby maker, but left the playpen. Mm-hmm. Like, oh God, Grandma, you and your keystone. So I went a year of remission after the hysterectomy, and it came back. Cancer came back in my lymphatic system, where I had to pursue aggressive chemotherapy about 4 or 5 months. And at that point, my mom was a wanted fugitive in the state of Illinois, and she had came up soliciting that she was here to help me and to be here for me. And I couldn't imagine, but really the actuality was she was still running and she was afraid to go to prison and lose me to cancer. And she was just faced with all of her regret in that moment. You know, Phil and Rylan, my little sister Karma, my mom, they all took their turns at shaving my head. And I'll never forget this video. My sister was recording it and it was of me and then my mom. And my mom was shaving my head, but she was just crying silently. I had no idea she was crying until way later when I seen the video. But to see that emotion on her face and just to know that she's filled with just regret and resentment and facing a crossroads of incarceration, but potentially, you know, losing her daughter. I couldn't imagine. Even being in that moment, it's hard for me to fathom my mom's shoes. Because all she ever wanted to do was love and be loved. I know she wanted normal. Mm-hmm. normalcy, stability. And even though she had all of that, she didn't even have the emotional intelligence to realize that that's what she wanted, to realize that there was something else wrong with her. And she knew it, but it was just like she felt like maybe she harbored it in her heart, opposed to like it truly being a disease of her mind. Mm-hmm. And people treated her as that and mocked her and ridiculed her. And not saying she wasn't deserving of some of the stuff. I mean, she made some bad decisions as well, but nobody, I just feel as a human, nobody deserves to feel that way day in and day out. And then when addiction hits, it's just everything goes out. You go into survival mode and you're just using to numb and mask and escape, but it just prolongs the agony.
How long have you been cancer-free?
3 years.
Wow, good. I'm very, very happy for you. It's ovarian cancer?
Ovarian cancer, yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It came back the second time in my lymphatic system, and which is just rare. The whole thing's rare. I mean, less than 4% of the population has that type of dysgerminoma ovarian cancer. And out of the 4%, it's typically 50 to 70 years old. So for me to have no family history of that, being a non-smoker at the time, you know, at the time social drinker, it was a real old soul for real.
Absolutely.
Again, I think that it just is a part of my testimony and, you know, a part that it doesn't matter what atrocities you're facing, that just embrace it and accept it and find the lesson in the L. And
I like that. Find the lesson in the L. I love that.
Yes. Yeah. Just move forward. And that's been my blinking arrow is, I mean, I remember my mom and my dad are both beautiful, charismatic, outgoing, fun people that you're like, what are they going to say? You're naturally just drawn to them, but they're also very sick with codependency, manipulation, control, neglect, abandonment, betrayal, addiction, alcoholism. And I just remember at 13, I was like, I don't want to be this way of my parents. So I will never be the girl that's walking out with my heels of the club. I want to be this light. I want to be this inspiration, this motivation. I want to be the exception to the rule.
I think you are. And I think you're proving that every single day. So I'm so glad you're here today.
I really appreciate this opportunity.
In closing, because we could talk forever because it just, I've had tears in my eyes for the last hour plus. Your story is just, it really touches my heart. So I really thank you for being here. Currently, where's your mom at today?
My mom is currently in Logan Correctional Facility. It's a maximum security penitentiary in Illinois. She has some aggravated battery assaults on police officers from some drunken incidents that had put her in a maximum security prison.
How many years is she looking at right now?
5.
You seem to carry a lot of weight on your shoulders. Mm-hmm. So I just want to give that perspective of what it's like for you now with your mother facing 5 years and you're carrying that weight with you. You're doing the time as well.
Mm-hmm. I must say, with this being mom's second prison bed, the weight feels that much more heavy on my shoulders. I don't have my stepdad helping support her financially, emotionally, in visits and stuff either. So it's all on me, you know, and going to prison is kind of expensive too. So I carry my mom with me every day, whether it's some toxic behaviors that I am like, oh my gosh, I am my mother. Or if it's just how I'm cooking, if it's the scents of candles and the lighting in my home, if it is the fresh sheets or the dryer sheets and the laundry soap smell. My mom, I feel, is a big part of my core. I mean, it sounds like cliche or sounds so obvious, but for me to embody so much of my mom with her being such a stranger isn't easy. And it isn't easy to navigate my feelings. It's almost as if I became numb to it because it's so familiar. But at the same time, it's like, why is my face wet from crying? Obviously, I feel this. It's just like caged inside me that it needs that release. And I think that opportunities like this reentry podcast and, you know, other
platforms.
Yes, yeah. Just other platforms that we can rekindle and reconnect and heal together and grow together.
I love that. Thank you. I have so many more questions, but I think we need to do a part two because I could go on all day. Thank you so much for being here today, Casey. And I wish you nothing but the best. I wish you healing. I hope Caden hears this. I hope you can reconnect. I wish nothing but health and happiness for you. You deserve it. So thank you so much for sharing and letting us be an outlet for you.
Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you for the listeners and everybody at Mirror Inc. and this reentry podcast. It is a full-time job outside of your full-time job. So I appreciate you all giving me the opportunity to share my story, and hopefully I can inspire others who have a loved one incarcerated that just keep writing, because when you're writing your letters, when you're writing your poetry, you're getting that emotion out, but you're also forcing yourself to be clear with your thoughts in order to write them down. And guess what? The beauty is you can't get hung up on. Nobody can interrupt you when you're writing. I feel that that has been a way to ground us again. And even though it's difficult, as you have read, to navigate some of Mom's letters with her being so angry and hurt, it's still unfamiliar with what she's going through right now. But at the same time, I would just encourage to write, to forgive, to open that dialogue, to show love and support to the incarcerated victim.
Thank you. This is Melissa Goodman and Casey Kern with Reentry Reframed, a Mirror Inc. sponsored podcast.